Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I am so excited. Alex, who have we got on today?
This is the most squealy you've been so far, I think. We're thrilled to welcome the lovely Bethany Hughes today. If you don't know Bethany Hughes, then who are you? We don't want to know you, certainly. I mean, she's all over your television telling you amazing stuff about the ancient world, the modern world. She's got such a diverse TV CV. She's also got a fantastic new series coming out about the Odyssey, which we can't wait for. But she thought we all needed a bit of love in the COVID-19 world. So we're going to talk about her last book, which was Venus and Aphrodite, goddesses of love, aren't they? So Bethany, hello, and thank you for coming to give us some relief from the doom and gloom.
Oh, such a pleasure. How nice to have a lovely voices to be talking to this morning. Really nice to chat.
You get human contact that aren't relatives. Exactly. People are starting to get really like antsy about that, aren't they?
So honestly, I've been working on a history of the hug anyway, which I thought it was really interesting what we do with human contact. And oh my God, what are all the hugs going to be like when we're finally released from lockdown? They're just going to go on for about an hour each, aren't they? So
Do you think we'll go like completely overly British and not know what to do, and it'll just be like awkward both people going the same way, like, oh, I don't know how to do it anymore?
Probably all of that too. We should all film ourselves, I reckon. Do the first five hugs and post them.
Yeah, that would be quite funny, and it would beat all of the ridiculous memes of people queuing not 2 meters apart and policing each other and complaining online because someone stood too close to them, which my mum is terrible now for. She randomly walked around Sainsbury's this morning screaming at people because they weren't 2 meters away from her. It's now her bugbear. So I can't do this for much longer, frankly. So hugs would be welcome.
No. Well, I do a funny thing that I'm actually delivering medicine to a couple of my friends who are in proper quarantine. You know, they're 12 weeks because they're kind of vulnerable. And so I'm delivering medicine and prescriptions and food to them on the bike. So I have basically become Call the Midwife.
Do you pretend you're in Call the Midwife?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I did. You know what massively made me so excited? It was unreal. So now I now have a parking pass as an NHS responder. So when I'm delivering or doing something, I can just put the pass on my windshield that says I'm NHS if I need to just park. You're not supposed to park anywhere stupid, and it's only when you're on duty. But I just really love the idea of going, sorry, I'm on call, everybody.
Oh, quite right. I'm
on call. Right. Can't ticket me.
Privilege. Quite yeah. Right.
I just make me feel like a doctor, which I'm completely not because I didn't even pass biology, I don't think. It's interesting, isn't it? But let's talk some history. Alina, kick us off.
Let's talk about love and history. So obviously Aphrodite, she's a Greek goddess. She has to come first, but isn't the first goddess of love, is she? Where did the Greek get the idea from?
No, that's right. So I think we say the name Aphrodite or Venus and we imagine this sort of classical goddess, but like almost everything in the classical world, they have much more ancient, even prehistoric, and often either Eastern or African roots. And if you look at Aphrodite, she's a really particular case in point. So she's kind of part of a family of goddesses that go right the way back 5,000, 6,000 years ago, and are very firmly situated in the Middle East. So she has these kind of great-great-grandmothers, in particular three goddesses called Inanna, Ishtar and Astarte. And these are really feisty creatures. So these are these young teenage goddesses who are the goddesses of love and sex, but also war. So it's really fascinating, and it kind of helps us understand Aphrodite much better, that they're basically goddesses of desire, of kind of, as humans, we desire to do things for good and for bad, and that can lead us into lovemaking, or it can lead us into conflict making and the creation of war. So she has this kind of Middle Eastern genetic seam running through her, and she also has a goddess who was born on Cyprus, on the island of Cyprus, who's a fertility and nature goddess. So she's much older than just the Greeks, and she's also got a much more interesting pedigree, and it gives her a kind of edge which carries on through her life story.
I love the story of how she's like born, if you like, for the Greeks. How does Aphrodite come into the Hellenistic world?
Yeah, well, that's it. It's not a pretty story. I think sometimes when you say the name Venus, you have this sort of Pavlovian response and you imagine this kind of Botticelli kind of wafting around. And oh, my goodness, it was much more hardcore than that. So the Greeks told this story that she was basically born out of a kind of primordial night. And Gaia, the great earth goddess, was eternally, joylessly copulating with her husband, who was also her son, because there was a lot of that that went on in the Greek world.
Yeah.
Uranus, the god of the sky. And as they were making love, she was constantly getting pregnant and her children were being trapped inside her. And one day, Gaia, the great earth goddess, just decides enough is enough. And she persuades one of her other sons, Kronos, to take up everybody who's kind of got male genitalia, cross your legs when you're listening to this, to take up a serrated flint sickle with which Kronos cuts off his father's penis and testicles and throws them into the sea. And the story goes that when this kind of bloody, frothing spume hits the water, there's this a bit of magic, and out of it suddenly emerges from this really sort of hideous, gory mess what's described in the Greek sources as an awful, lovely maiden. And that awful, lovely maiden is the goddess Aphrodite, who then steps ashore from the sea. And as she walks onto the barren earth, grasses and flowers start to grow up beneath her feet. So she brings the beauty of nature and fertility to the earth. But again, it's a kind of reminder that she is absolutely not just a pretty face, and she's not a fluffy thing. It's kind of telling us that sex is dangerous, and that that we have to be very careful with our passions and what we do with them. I think
I'm pretty sure every man listening to this has got his legs crossed and his eyes watering right now. I love it. As a girl, I thought that was brilliant.
Might as well get the men squirming, why not? We need to do it once in a while.
They get enough war and man stuff on this podcast. They can listen to some emasculation every now and again.
Why not? Let's move on to The Odyssey, which is one of my favourite of all time books. And we're obviously talking about Aphrodite, and she was married to Hephaestus. But what do we actually learn from the book, from The Odyssey? I mean, one man isn't enough for her, is he?
No, she's quite, you know, as you kind of might expect from the goddess of sex and desire and sexual love, she's quite keen on lovemaking, Aphrodite. And she is married to Hephaestus, who's a god of volcanoes. He's a blacksmith god. He's lame. And she decides to have an affair with Ares or Mars in the Roman pantheon, the god of war. And that's no coincidence, because if you think about what we were discussing before about her origins being with these incredible Middle Eastern goddesses who are actually goddesses of war as well as love, it makes sense that that kind of idea stays with the Greeks, and so they give her this illicit union with Ares. And it's a really funny moment. It's a very popular myth, this, and the idea is that the gods espy her, kind of, she's caught in, you know, flagrante delicto with Ares, and it's a real sort of peeping Tom moment. They're suddenly all peering in on her making love to the god of war. But as I said, it's, you know, it's why I love the myths, because they're amazing stories, but they're tools to think with, you know, that they sort of teach us how to think about the world. And again, I think what that is saying is that we're just sort of pushed to do things. You know, I think we all know it's very hard to be good. It's very easy to be bad. It's very hard to be good. And Aphrodite, in a sense, is the kind of incarnation of that. She's the goddess of mixis, of mixing things up. So the fact that she mixes herself up with the god of war, again, as I said, it's just a little reminder that when we desire things, that could be a good, and desire in itself is good, and human ambition is great, but we have to be really careful which path it leads us down. And if it leads us down on a path that results in kind of violence and suffering for others, then obviously we should try to resist it. But yeah, so Aphrodite has this affair with Ares. She's also very keen on mortals, so she likes a mortal man as well. So she has various children who are then half divine, half mortal.
I love the deeper meaning to this mythology. It's not really not someone just hasn't randomly thought up like a soap opera for these gods, have they? There's so much hidden meaning and depth to them. But tell us about Aphrodite and Adonis.
Yeah, so Aphrodite, it's a really interesting one, this, because this is unrequited love. So Aphrodite falls in love with the beautiful young man, Adonis, and is so kind of enraptured with him and desperate to have him. And he's out hunting, and there's a terrible hunting accident, and he dies, and his blood comes onto the earth, and where it spatters on the earth, these beautiful red anemones grow up, and Aphrodite is distraught. So it's, again, it's a sort of, it's talking about how we can sometimes fall in love with those that we shouldn't fall in love with, or kind of unexpected affairs. But really fascinatingly, that also goes back to those early Middle Eastern stories, because in that, the great goddesses, these great goddesses, Inanna, she has an affair with a mortal kind of huntsman shepherd boy called Dumuzi, and it's exactly the same story. So it's again the Greeks taking a much older myth and turning it into their own. But yeah, so Aphrodite and Adonis, that's a very popular story downtime. And Shakespeare, one of Shakespeare's kind of most profitable works was the story of Aphrodite and Adonis. It was very sexy. It's a really interesting fact that when Shakespeare wrote about it, it was so sort of considered so sort of lurid and titillating that hardly any of the original copies of the poem have survived, because they were literally so well thumbed. So people just kind of kept on reading them, like, kind of
I love that it wasn't that they just got destroyed because people were prudish. I love that they were just so well used that they didn't survive. That's good.
Well, they were literally worn out with avid reading.
I mean, I'm loving all of this. We definitely needed something like this to talk about, to lift our spirits a little bit. But talking about books that we were talking about earlier, the Iliad, which is another really, really, really great book. She had a major role in that, didn't she?
She did, yeah. So she, in a way, you could argue that Aphrodite starts the whole Trojan War, because the story goes that there was a great society wedding in the Greek world, and the king Peleus was marrying Thetis, the nymph Thetis. It was a grand sort of society wedding. And anyone who was anyone was invited, all the aristocrats and kings and queens and gods and goddesses. But somebody had left Eris, the goddess of strife, off the wedding guest list. And if any of you got married, you'll know, like, wedding guest lists are a nightmare at the best of times. But the one person you would not choose to leave off is the goddess of strife. So furious, she turns up at this wedding anyway. And again, this interestingly is the beginning of the Sleeping Beauty myth. So she turns up at the door, throws open the gates, and hurls down a golden apple. And on the golden apple are written the words "for the fairest." And of course, all the gods and goddesses and queens and nobles are there. So it's a really clever little act of destabilization. Mm. And Zeus, the king of the gods, says, "I couldn't possibly choose who is the fairest." So he sends his messenger, Hermes, off to Mount Ida in Turkey, and Paris, Prince Paris, the Trojan prince who ends up having the affair with Helen of Troy, is given this choice to make. So is it Athena, who's going to give him great prowess and war? Is it Hera, the goddess Hera, who's going to give him dominion over the earth? Or is it Aphrodite, the goddess of love? And we're told that at this time, Paris is only a kind of 15-year-old boy. So Aphrodite loosens her girdle and just whispers to him, "I have nothing I can give you apart from the most beautiful woman in the world." And Paris, as you can imagine, decides that that is the gift that he wants. So he chooses Aphrodite.
Being a man.
Yeah, I know. As the fairest of the goddesses. And then she puts Helen in his path, and then Helen and Paris elope together, and that causes the Trojan War. So in a way, it's Aphrodite and her act, which creates the whole of the Iliad story. So she's also involved, and she's on the side of the Trojans, and she sort of whisks Paris off the battlefield at one point. So she's very present there. So for the Greeks, you know, you've got to remember that they didn't have a separate word for religion. For them, gods and goddesses and demigods were everywhere and in everything. So they would really have thought that there was this power, this potent power, that they gave a name and a face to and called Aphrodite, who controlled affairs, who'd made history, who'd made myth, and who was still present in their lives.
She's actually famous for her temper, though, isn't she?
And she is, yeah. She's not... She's not demure at all.
I'm glad. I know.
Yeah, no. She's she's kind of, she, if you think about her, she's passion, you know, isn't she? So she flies off the handle. She's supposed to be very kind of fiery. She's not a comfortable creature at all. I mean, what I think is really interesting about her downtime is that if you look at her, how she's first represented, she's represented with great respect and with fear. And when people talk about her being beautiful and golden and shimmering and having shimmering breasts, they're not actually sexualizing her. They're talking about her physical power and her material power and the fact that she is in charge of much of all the activity of men and animals and nature in the known world. So she's hugely, hugely respected. And then downtime, it's almost like as you follow her progress, you watch the process of women being slowly, slowly reduced in power to second class citizens. And as that happens, Aphrodite becomes this naked goddess, a nude goddess who's a bit of a sort of sexual pin-up. She becomes less potent. She becomes just part of the pantheon. So she's a really, really interesting character to follow through time because her story basically is a version of the story of the world.
I mean, tell us, so this to me was clearly written by a man, what I'm going to ask you for now, because I, as a total novice, are there shades of Eve in this? And tell us about the story of Pandora.
Yeah, well, so Pandora, the first created woman, we're told, who really interestingly is called Pandora in some of the versions of Hesiod's story. But in another version, she's simply called, the first created woman is simply called the Kalon Kakon, the beautiful evil thing. So she's evil because she's beautiful because she's evil, and she's both of those because she's female. So there's this terrible notion that with the advent of mortal woman, basically the world is stuffed. And you know, the Greeks were really open about this. So there's a hideous poem written by a very popular poet called Simonides, who's from the island of Amorgos. And Simonides writes this, I mean, it's dreadful thing about how, you know, women, some women are like dogs, some women are like pigs, some women are like foxes, you know, they sit on a shit pile, they interfere. And then there's this awful line, he says, you know, a sensible man keeps his wife quiet by knocking her teeth out with a stone, you know, and that women were sent to play.
Nice.
I know, really nice. But I mean, it's really, you know, you can't get away from that terrible, terrible misogyny. And as you say, it's really interesting Aphrodite's role in that, because she becomes demonized as well. And there's this notion that rather than sex being a beautiful and a potent thing to be worshipped and adored, it's a dangerous thing that diverts men from their kind of proper course of building civilizations and running armies. It weakens them. Sex is a bad thing and it's a woman's fault. So before we even get a kind of Judeo-Christian idea of womanhood in that way, you definitely find those hints in the Aphrodite story.
Ugh.
I know, yeah. Shame, isn't it? I always think people kind of talk about why things are unequal. I think, well, you know, we've got like 3,500 years of total inequality. So it's no surprise there's quite a lot of catching up to do. But in a weird way, I sometimes think that's almost helpful because it shows that we are changing, you know, that we've got this terrible backstory of inequity and of it just being part and parcel of life for 3,500 years. So yeah, actually the changes that we should be really celebrating, all those changes that are happening.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about worship. How did people worship her in ancient Greece, and what favor did they expect to gain from her?
Yeah, so she was very present in ancient Greece. If you think of Athens and the Acropolis rock, you know, the famous Parthenon on the top of the Acropolis in Athens, probably one of the most famous monuments from the whole of antiquity. That whole rock was sacred to Aphrodite. So it was the goddess Aphrodite's rock. And if you go today, you can walk around it, if we're ever allowed back out of lockdown. Yeah. And you can actually see there are niches carved into the rock where Aphrodite was honoured and worshipped. Really sweetly today, people still go and leave little pomegranates in her honor there. But she was very present. She was a great, considered a great patroness of cities. And I think this is really relevant and really important. She was thought to be a patroness of cities like Athens, what became Constantinople, in what's modern day Turkey. Because she was, as we said before, she was this kind of goddess of mixis, of mixing things up. So there's this idea that when you get a lot of people living together, human relationships are hard at the best of times, but you have a city full of humans, it's going to be really hard. So you need a goddess who's keeping an eye on those relationships and encouraging people to find ways to live together through compassion and understanding. So for instance, in democratic Athens, she was worshipped as Aphrodite, Harmonia and Harmonia. So Aphrodite of union and harmony. So she was very actively worshipped, not just to in terms of like sexual relationships, but in terms of human relationships. And the idea that she provided almost this kind of cosmic glue that allowed society to stick together.
Moving on to Venus, because obviously you associate Aphrodite, then you think of Venus. She's just the Roman adaptation of Aphrodite, isn't she?
She is. Yeah, she is. So Venus basically, well, it's a kind of, there's a bit of a union again. So in the Roman territories, they have this kind of early fertility goddess who's called Venus. And really interestingly, the word Venus comes from the proto-Indo-European root of vanas, desire. So it means exactly the same thing as Aphrodite. So they have this fertility goddess, and they kind of meld her together with Aphrodite as they take over Greek territories and territories in North Africa. And then so Aphrodite sort of pretty much becomes Venus. And she's hugely important to the Romans. The Romans love her. They think of her as the kind of mother of the Roman nation because she gives birth to Aeneas, to the Trojan hero Aeneas. And Aeneas, then eventually his dynasty goes on to give birth to the Julians and Romulus and Remus, who found Rome. So in their heads, she was their like kind of superpowered, supernatural godmother, literally godmother of the Roman state. And again, they remember that she was a goddess of war as well as love. So generals like Julius Caesar used to wear a ring with an image of Venus on. She gets her temples set up in the Forum, and great Roman generals will go and worship her and make sacrifice to her before they go into battle. So she's really important to the Romans.
How Romans use her adapts over time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So she starts off, as I said, as this kind of goddess of war and love. And increasingly you see her represented armed, but in Roman sculptures. So she's often naked, but with a helmet and a spear. And again, she becomes something that they kind of recognize she's very useful for cities. So she's often the patroness of cities. Again, that thing of kind of keeping people mixed up and mixed together. And women really love her. So Cleopatra, you know, very caught up in the Roman world, dresses herself as Aphrodite. She kind of wears literally like a kind of golden red hairpiece. So she looks like Aphrodite, and she wears Aphrodite's golden sandals. So so she's very present in the Roman world. And she's slightly, though, once you get the Roman Empire, Augustus, again, it sort of slightly becomes, she almost sort of, it's almost as if she's got that a bit of a dirty secret feel about her. So rather than her image being everywhere, often it gets tucked away into bathrooms and private rooms. And it's that idea of the sort of illicit nature of some sex. So you almost see the beginning of kind of modern ideas right the way back in the Roman period.
How does she appear in Roman mythology?
So she's there. I mean, you know, Venus is one of their favourite characters. So she turns up, Venus and Adonis, they love that story. She appears really interestingly in the Roman period. Again, it's a Greek town that's called Aphrodisias. But I think it's fascinating that so Aphrodisias, as it sounds, is a whole town that's dedicated to Aphrodite. She's very much adored and honoured there. but she went in Aphrodisias, there's a guy called Caraton who sort of invents the novel. So he starts to write these kind of romantic love stories featuring Aphrodite. And basically it's how all popular fiction is born. So she's very responsible for inspiring a lot of art and ideas of romantic love. And that carries right the way down to the troubadour time. So particularly troubadours who are returning from the Crusades, who'd kind of picked up on those Eastern traditions, they will write these love songs about Aphrodite and about Venus and about unrequited love, like Venus's love for Adonis. And those songs and forms of words directly relate to our pop songs today. So she's sort of responsible for the novel and for every pop song.
I've literally just made the
connection. I might be stretching it a bit there to say every pop song.
I've literally just made the connection to the word aphrodisiac.
Yeah, aphrodisiac.
I'm quite slow on the uptake.
Yeah, that's right. If we think of, aphrodisiacs, that's all to do with Aphrodite. Venereal disease is the disease of Venus. So let's hope that
I see a lot of that in the First World War.
I'm sure.
Talk to us about festivals. The Romans go all out to pay tribute, mass tribute to Venus, don't they? And are they expecting the same thing as the Greeks? It's slightly different, isn't it?
I mean, she becomes a kind of goddess of the streets as well. And what's interesting is that she's very much in the Greek world. There are priests of Aphrodite, and actually, really interestingly, some of the priests of Aphrodite in the Greek world are actually kind of show female characteristics as well. So the sculptures of them, they're very definitely men with beards, but they have breasts. And even some of the figurines of Aphrodite from that early Greek world, from Cyprus, for instance, it's a beautiful set of figurines of her and a kind of wafty chiton. Again, she's got breasts, but she's got a beard. So it's playing on that idea that we are neither just male nor female, that we're very mixed up, which is a very kind of ancient prehistoric idea with the goddess Aphrodite as well, that she allows us to be both male and female.
Is that the connection as well between homoerotic love, like men, the way men loved each other isn't necessarily the way we think of it when we think of two men being in love with each other?
You've got to completely take off your kind of 21st century head, basically, and imagine the world. I mean, I think, you know, it's what I love about ancient history is 9 times out of 10 they got there first. You know, we always imagine that we're kind of pioneering and we've suddenly become, you know, much more sensitive and open-minded, and the ancients absolutely explore that idea of gender fluidity and the possibilities of being transgender, and they lionize it and absolutely encapsulate that in the worship of Aphrodite. But right the way back to Inanna, so as the Middle Eastern kind of great grandmother of Aphrodite, one of the great hymns of praise to her says that she turns a woman into a man and a man into a woman, and when she was worshipped, male priests would dress as women, female priestesses would dress as men, with the idea that she was a goddess who had both male and female in her, and that you should find the male and female in yourself. So, I mean, really, 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 really fascinating. So, yes, so it is those, their ideas of sexuality were very different, but very modern in some ways. But with the Roman world, as often happens, she tends to be taken over by male priests. So her worship and adoration is sort of becomes part of that kind of structure of empire, which is very male dominated.
If I'm not wrong, Venus is, she's hugely represented in post-classical art. For example, the painting, The Birth of Venus. Am I right?
You are. Botticelli.
Venus de Milo as well.
Venus de Milo, exactly. All of it. She's. If you think about it, you know what? Almost every image of a naked woman that you probably kind of imagine is a woman, if you actually look at it, it's usually a representation of Venus in for about 700 years. So she kind of gives this brilliant license to artists to say, look, you can have a very titillating image of a naked woman, but we'll call it a goddess, so it makes it okay and acceptable. And also what's really important is that often the models for those goddess figures were prostitutes and sex workers and call girls. So they're the kind of and these were actually, they were called prostitutes of the of that time, were often called Venuses. So it was a Venus was a kind of slang name for a sex worker. So it's really fascinating. So she's there, she's very present in loads of slicks of oil on paint, on the great canvases, you know, the Rokeby Venus in the National Gallery, very famous sort of back view of Venus, as I said, of many paintings that we think are just actually women, they are of the goddess, because it's sort of somehow, as I said, it kind of gave you an excuse to put a lot of female flesh on show, and people weren't just saying that you were being objectifying, that you were kind of you're just being very mythological.
Yeah, very cultural. Yes. So just let's finish off then. How has Aphrodite and Venus been remembered in the modern world? They're still culturally important to some groups, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, there'll be some people who'll be listening to this podcast who are goddess worshippers, who thinks that she is absolutely kind of with us today. She's there, you know, if you, she turns up a lot in all, you know, anything from Bananarama to Kylie Minogue to Lady Gaga. They talk about Aphrodite and Venus in their lyrics. She's there in on Valentine's Day. The rose was the one of the flowers of Venus, and that's why we give red roses on Valentine's Day. So she is absolutely present. I mean, I think controversially, I think some aspects of the Virgin Mary actually taken from Aphrodite. So the fact that she has a dove and a girdle and kind of nurtures Jesus, that's, those are all very Venus Aphrodite-esque images. But I think in a bigger way, she's with us still, because really why she was invented, as I said, was to try to work out how we negotiate human relationships and what we do with desire for good and for bad. But more than that, how we lived this brilliant, crazy, mixed up life that humans live, where we choose to live together in groups, either great or small. And that is her great gift to the world, is that she helps us understand that we, no woman or man is an island, that we have others around us, and it's incredibly important to invest in those relationships and to work out a way that we can live together and love one another, and that is the only way that civilization itself can survive. So she is with us, and I think ever more importantly now, you know, when we hear of how people are dealing with corona, don't they all say they use that word love, that's what's got people through, and that's what's made people do the incredible acts of heroism on the front line, and we do it because of love. So she's definitely not irrelevant. She's definitely a goddess for our age.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on and cheering us up today, because we do some depressing stuff on this podcast.
Oh.
And it's just nice to have like a nice chat about something nice like love.
Yes,
exactly.
And it's not pointless and irrelevant. You've just told us exactly why it's not. So just tell everybody, you did a book about Venus and Aphrodite, didn't you?
I did. So Venus and Aphrodite, so I've done the sort of history of the goddess, looking at her life story through time, going right the way back to prehistory up until today. And she's immortal, of course, so she just carries on, so she'll have a future as well.
Means you can do a sequel.
I can do a sequel. Exactly. Yeah. So it's a little, I usually write these massive books that are basically kind of, you know, you can use to kill burglars with as well. But this one is a very slim little, it's a love letter to Aphrodite, really.
I wouldn't trade in my burglar killing copy of Istanbul for anyone. I have to get you back on to talk about that. I had to cancel a trip to Istanbul because of coronavirus. I feel very sorry for myself. I've never been, so completely self-indulgently, I would love you to come and talk to us about that. But when is Odyssey on?
So honestly, we're doing the final touches to the final programme, and I hope it will be out in May. So we're finishing it off now. So it's a 6-part series, sort of very loosely following the trail of Odysseus and exploring the Greek islands and doing a modern day Odyssey. Yeah, so it was a lot of fun. We filmed that, the last day of filming was the day before lockdown started in Europe. So we finished it by the skin of our teeth, but we just managed it.
I bet your face lit up when you saw the locations for that, though.
Oh, so amazing. We had to pinch ourselves a lot, me and my lovely cameraman who I work with, go like, this really isn't a holiday.
I just get like sweaty libraries. I spend my life in the Interplanetary Society in a rather musty smelling library with bits of space debris on the wall is where we do most of my stuff. Nice. So I'm jealous.
Yes, there we are. Well, we are. I had to take one for the team, you know. Somebody's going to do that, Aegean Odyssey.
Yeah, it's my fault for not picking classical history, but yeah.
I'm definitely going to have to download this, like, totally illegally from Poland, because obviously I'm not in the UK, so I won't be able to watch it on TV. So download button it goes.
Oh, yeah. We'll try and make sure it goes to Poland. Let me try and work on that. I'll try and get out on Viasat there. Or
I don't know if I can wait that long, I'm afraid. I'm going to have to illegally start doing it on the internet. So.
Or I will Zoom call you with the video while it's on. Yeah. You can watch the TV on Zoom.
Enjoy. Very kind of you. Thanks for that. But thank you so much again, Bettany. It was amazing having you on our show. And sorry for a bit of fangirling, but there we are.
Total pleasure. Put a smile on my face. So no, lovely to chat to you. And we'll catch up again to talk about Istanbul, maybe.
Brilliant. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Join us tomorrow for our Hornblower reunion. We are so excited to share it with you. We had an absolute blast sitting down with Johan Griffith and Jamie Bamber to talk all about the series and their careers. And we asked all your questions about whether or not there will be any new episodes of Hornblower as well. So tune in for that. Don't forget, if you would like to become a patron of History Hack and help us keep going after the end of this COVID-19 crisis, you can do so at historyhack.podbean.com. It's much appreciated. There now follows a public service announcement.
I'm Horatio Hornblower.
And I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders.
Indeed. The regulation is very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.